I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Elizabeth Markovitz, professor of political science at Mount Holyoke College. We're discussing her 2018 book, Future Freedoms, Intergenerational Justice, Democratic Theory, and Ancient Greek Tragedy and Comedy from Routledge. Markovitz works on ancient political thought and contemporary democratic theory and is the author of The Politics of Sincerity, Frank Speech, Plato, and Democratic Judgment, and many other articles. So first of all, Liz, let me say thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me. It really is. I'm looking forward to this conversation and have enjoyed your other podcasts.
Great. So I love the book. It's a great combination of both an intervention in contemporary political theory and democratic theory on the topic of intergenerational justice, and also several really penetrating readings of Greek tragedies and comedies. So this is a kind of unique combination, and I very much enjoyed it. So let me first start by asking you how you came to write the book. What motivated you to write about intergenerational justice, and why did you use the Greeks as your focus?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess there's an easy answer to the question of why I use the Greeks, and that's because I knew that material. So I was often asked that during the process, well, why the Greeks? And it's like, well, because I spent time studying ancient Greek and I want to use that.
Right.
I did make a move from my previous book was on, I work more with Plato and Thucydides. And during that time, I always loved, I love that there's a sort of limited canon when dealing with Greek tragedy and comedy, right? We just don't even have that many sources. And so I feel like I can read all of this. I can work through it and really spend some time digging deeply. So that was a really enjoyable sort of post-first book moment. I'm just going to read a lot of plays. And that was part of it. I just wanted to write about those texts. So as I'm reading about them, I'm noticing these things. And so as, I started the project back when I was in St. Louis at St. Louis University. And I was thinking, what's that next project? It always seemed difficult to make that move from first project where you have all that. I was very fortunate in my graduate career at UNC to have a very nurturing environment. So I worked a lot. Susan Bickford was my advisor, and I worked a lot with Peter Ubin. And, you know, that first book was, I don't want to say easy, but that's really different. You feel like you're in this community, you're talking to these people all the time. And then you go out and you get your first job, and maybe you're the only one of you in a department or at a university. So I really wanted to think carefully about what I wanted to do, what I wanted to spend my time on, and what I would be able to do. And it was at that time I was hanging out a lot just socially in the neighborhood, and then professionally with Jim Bowman. He's a political philosopher who was working on cosmopolitan democracy at that time. And he had done a lot on deliberative theory, which my first book discussed. And so I was thinking just in conversations there about these new ideas about citizenship and expanding it. I also read Elizabeth Cohen's really great book, Semi-Citizenship, around that time, and looking at those holes that are there and those remainders and left behinds. And she does a really good job of analyzing the categories and different ways it could be seen, which is pretty different from my work in a lot of ways. But I found that book really generative. So that's one set of sort of intellectual currents. I'm trying to think about what to do at that time. And I'm talking with and reading about these other ideas. And they seemed really new and new ways of thinking about democracy to me. I was also starting to pay more attention to my own family, of myself as placed in between generations. My friends were starting to have children. I was thinking about that. I'd always been sort of deeply ambivalent. Like, I didn't not want children, but I wasn't sure I wanted them. I was really torn. And so I was making those decisions, thinking about the meaning of those decisions. I also had aging parents. So I was thinking about that a lot. So I think, you know, as I was thinking about what's missing from citizenship, my attention sort of, not naturally, but influenced by my own life, turned to those spots. And the intergenerational themes in Aeschylus's work were so obvious to me that I started there. And then let that simmer for a little while and started looking around for what else I could find. And Aristophanes pops up as an obvious thing. So it's a long answer to your question, but I really like thinking about that connection between what's going on in one's own life, the intellectual currents out there, and how you get to it.
So. Yeah, and it seemed like climate change, too, which is something that's very much on the in the news quite frequently and is quite scary. It, you know, also seemed to be a motivating factor. I mean, this question about what, you know, what are we doing to our planet and how that's going to affect future generations.
Right. And there's a way in which sometimes writing about things for many people I know is a way of dealing with it. And I have to admit, I'm fairly terrified by the actually occurring climate change around us, especially as the parent of children who are now old enough to be asking me questions about it. And writing about it is one way of dealing with my own terror at the situation. So that was always hanging out there as a motivator. I tried not to directly focus on that in the book and think more broadly about intergenerational themes, in part because there are people who are doing really great work specifically on climate change. And that seems like a whole area of expertise. I want, you know, I hope more people read that material as well. I want to think conceptually more broadly about the problem.
Yeah, so let's turn to that, the concept of intergenerational justice. I mean, I guess the first question is what does that mean? Your book's titled Future Freedom. So, I mean, part of your focus is on what is the just treatment of future generations? What do we owe to future generations? But I take it it's also what do we owe to the past as well, right? Mm-hmm. How is justice relevant not just to the present, but to people who have died and people who are yet to be born? Is that right?
Yeah. And I think it's, again, this is one of those areas where people have been doing really interesting work. I'm thinking about Jeff Spinner-Halev, who came to UNC right as I was leaving. So I was introduced to his work there. And that always seemed, you know, was compelling to me and very interesting. And so there are people who are specifically focused on the past in this way. And the future always grabbed my attention a little bit more because it's so, in many ways, impossible to think about. Right? We do have definite individuals who existed in the past. Now, we can lose their histories and they can be erased in that way Arendt worries about, right? If we erased all traces and no one remembered or talked about, then they're gone. But the future people, we don't even know who they are. And so it's much more difficult to make a case for dealing with them because what are we dealing with? And I liked the muddiness of that problem in a lot of ways. I think when you asked about, you know, the book title, but then the title's about freedom, the subtitle's about justice, I think that reflects my own thinking about the problem over time. There's a literature out there on intergenerational justice. There are books titled that. And they tend to be that very Rawlsian approach that I discuss in chapter one. So that is a body of work I wanted to make an intervention in some way. And so that language is useful, but I think in the end, I move more toward a vision of what freedom would mean, because over and over again, what seemed more part of what I believe is driving this absence of discussion is our attempt for a sovereign form of freedom over the present and over the future. that is deeply problematic.
Yeah, it seems like what you're interested in general is less to do with, I guess, just to put it in like the simplified form, which is probably not exactly accurate, but sort of the concerns about material redistribution mm-hmm. and material wealth, and more about the concerns for, as you say, the freedom of future generations, that they have, I mean, the freedom, of course, on your view, requires certain kind of material preconditions, but it's really that kind of core human need for freedom, it seems, that you're that forms the like sort of normative core of your thoughts about justice. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that's right. And also that the motivational side, the affective side, right? Because as I was reading much of the literature on intergenerational justice, people who said they were working out these terms, I thought, oh yeah, that's right. But nothing's happening out here, right? There mm-hmm. are these smart, thoughtful discussions among philosophers and political theorists and economists doing that work, but yet we're acting, you know, there's a sizable part of the population who says this isn't even happening. They aren't feeling the terror that I'm feeling. Or if they are, I've also talked to people like this and probably act like this in aspects of my life. And this is where I think Jade Schiff's work does a really good job of describing how we ignore injustice and the different forms of ignoring it. So I can see that a problem exists, but I just kind of throw up my hands, right? What am I going to do about it? And so I'm really interested in how we motivate people to come to want to do the right thing. Maybe you can even, some of these are just technocratic rather than political problems, I think. But we're still not doing something. So how do we motivate that? And so thinking about the ways people describe the soul craft of it. Right. What are we doing to get people to care?
Yeah. And that seems a definite problem, as you rightly bring out, with a Rawlsian type of approach here. So yeah, you've been mentioning the literature and how the literature answers the question of intergenerational justice. So maybe we could just briefly mm-hmm. sort of go through the different answers, because you survey them and offer your assessment in chapter one. So you offer three different discuss three different approaches: the generational sovereignty view associated with Jefferson, generational distribution view associated with Rawls, and the generational representation view associated with Habermas. So maybe you could just take us through maybe the you know, Jefferson, of course, all Americans, this Jefferson's view is sort of in our blood, as it were. I mean, we're sort of familiar with Jefferson's lines about the world belonging to the living and so forth. So he certainly has something to say about this question. So what's his view, and what's your assessment of it?
Yeah. So with Jefferson, he has this, it's interesting, this sort of this demand that the past not encroach on the present, right? Which then implies a demand that the present generation not make agreements, enter into contracts or treaties that will bind the next generation. And he just states this, right, as if one can easily accomplish this, as if the lines between generations are clear, right? You know, but he puts a 2-decade limit on it, right? And so for Jefferson, this motivating freedom, right, has a temporal aspect. Right, that I wouldn't be bound by choices my father made, right? It says every generation is sovereign, just like nations are. And so that does put an obligation on the present generation to the future, but it's this oddly very negative one. And so that's what he has. And I think, you know, I don't want to make it in the book, sometimes I fall into this, I think entirely normal, trying to make the connection between these moves in Athens and then the contemporary US. I want to say, note here, right, that Jefferson gets combined with this sort of capitalist hyper-consumption, Libby Anker's work that she's doing right now on I think she calls it consumptive freedom, right? So this, if I can consume all I want, right, that means I'm really free. You combine that with Jefferson, I think it's a really potent and dangerous force in contemporary U.S. politics, right? So that's the Jeffersonian view.
Yeah, although, I mean, you know, in some ways, I mean, so Jefferson has, you know, in Jefferson's view, the present generation has a duty to the future insofar as it, I think, as you rightly bring out in the book, that, I mean, it's sort of Lockean in a way, I guess, you know, like we need to, the present generation needs to leave as enough and as good for future generations. So in a way, you know, Jefferson would resist the kind of, you know, use it all up mindset of a kind of hyper-capitalism, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. He does have this, like I said, the present has this one negative obligation, not to destroy everything. But that's it. You know, and I think I'm not a Jefferson scholar, and so I'd leave it to other people, but I wonder if we go in, it's sort of in that Lockean move, right? There's plenty out there. There's no way you can use it all, right? Mm,
yeah, yeah.
And I just wonder if their horizon looked so different from ours that that's a, you know, to me, that's an unthinkable proposition, right? Of course we could use it all up. We're coming very close to that. There are people who advocate doing that, right? You know, use up all the fossil fuels while we can. So, you know, that's a question for historians, but... yeah, I think Jefferson would want us to leave a world that the future can inhabit. That seems sure. But that urge to sovereignty, to throw off the obligations of the past, I think is what's really the idealism in Jefferson coming out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strangely limiting view in a certain way. I was thinking about this. I mean, because so many human projects that we undertake are transgenerational, right? So it's, if you think, just take the sciences, you know, any kind of endeavor or question in the sciences is going to be a transgenerational task, so that, you know, every kind of effort that the past generation undertakes is going to be taken up by the new generation. So, you know, if each generation would scrap what the previous generation would do, there wouldn't be much progress. Right. So there's so many of these kinds of efforts in society that requires this kind of, you know, like relay race from generation to generation, and such that, you know, it's not just a negative duty, but a kind of positive duty. Right. That one would think to sort of benefit. I mentioned Burke to you before, but it sort of reminds me a little bit of Burke in the sense that, you know, you have this notion of an inheritance. I mean, Burke thinks about tradition as a kind of inheritance. And so you get the inheritance from the past, and a good son or daughter would take their inheritance and improve it and pass it on to the future. Right. And so Jefferson being very, very critical of that conservative view is, I think, is missing that element.
Right. And I think, you know, that's why I often turn to Arendt on this, because she states it so matter-of-factly. Of course you're getting good things from the past, right? You know, you're also inheriting the junk, but, you know, she's sins and blessings, I think is how she's putting it. But we're getting those things and we have to deal with them and take them up in some way, right? I feel like after exchanging emails with you, I'm going to go read some Burke and get onto that, because it does seem like a resource. And I know some people working in the intergenerational literature, I did some secondary, read some really interesting secondary discussions of Burke and how he sheds light on some of these problems.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that the famous quote about the, you know, society is indeed bound by a contract, but it's not a contract like among businessmen, but it's a contract of all generations, past, present, and future, and all the arts and sciences, and et cetera, et cetera. It's a really kind of powerful quote. I've often liked it for this kind of issue about how we think of our relationship to the past and the future. I mean, Burke is, you know, he's more conservative, so he wants the you know, so his focus is both on the past and the future, whereas your focus seems to be more on the future in that way.
It is on the future, but also I'm thinking of something my colleague here, Joan Cox, often pressed me on, which is that idea of conserving, you know, sorts of lifestyles or ways of doing things, right? There's also this American tendency, and I think this comes out more in Jefferson, right? This ever forward, let's plow ahead, right? If it's new, it must be good.
Right, right.
And that is deeply tied, I think, to capitalism and consumption and these ideas about freedom, right? Let's go forward. Let's try something new. And that's sort of embedded in, you know, if there's an American spirit, that aspect of it. But, you know, Joan and I would have conversations, and some of this is we live in a rural area here in Western Massachusetts, but there's Route 9 is, I say, it's where we have, it's paying the price for all our sins of capitalism and consumption, right? So we live in this beautiful rural area. There's so much conservation land, and there's this one town in between our two beautiful towns, this town of Hadley, that's decided the way it's going to make money is to have all the big box stores, right? Mm-hmm. So they have a huge tax base that my town of Amherst completely lacks, and we can't figure out how to, you know, fund our schools. But Hadley has all these businesses, and so many of us just go there to get our Trader Joe's or our Target, Walmart needs filled, right? And it's obliterated all this farmland. And Joan always remembered what that was like or would talk about that. And I've lived here 10 years now and have also started to see those changes and the way we're so quick to discard these old things in favor of the new, which ironically, you know, has this, I think, destructive effect on the future. So maybe there is a greater link to Burke than I even realized now that I'm talking it through with
you. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, that's interesting. Not to rattle on here, but when reading your book, one of the things that strikes me, and again, you have kids, I have a kid. Mm-hmm. One of the things you see in kids is that they're great, need for a connection to a history, yeah. Right? So that, you know, if something's only a couple years old or as old as they are, it's not that exciting. But if something goes back, you know, they want to find out what their origins are, how it goes back. And, you know, it's kind of exciting to be part of something that's lasted a long time. So we humans have a kind of need, it seems to me, to be connected to the past and to the future in these deep ways.
Mm-hmm. I mean, before you started recording, we were talking about my mother passed away in March, and my kids seeing their interest in her stories, and which has only increased really since her passing, right? My 6-year-old wants to know all sorts of things suddenly, and we talk about her every day now in a way we weren't doing a year ago. And, you know, they want to know, how did Gramps and Grandma meet, and where did they get married, and what are the, you know, all these things. And it's really been interesting, you know, because we live so far away from my family and we didn't see them that often. Thanks to FaceTime, we saw them a lot more often than we would have 20 years ago. But it, you know, this need with my children to know a lot more. My 10-year-old wants to learn Hungarian because my father's Hungarian, right? Mm. Like, it's not going to be a useful language, likely, honey. It's difficult. Give it your best shot. Here's an app. Go. You know, what's his connection to it? Just the idea that his grandfather is Hungarian, right? And I can't dissuade him or persuade him that Spanish or Mandarin might be more useful right now. But yeah, that need is obvious to me as a parent now, in a way it wasn't 20 years ago when I was in my 20s and just ready to, you know, I was in a more ever onward, what's new?
Right. Cast off the past. Yeah. Yes. The youthful renewal. Yeah. Maybe just before we move on to Rawls, just to nail this point, because you make it, you know, it becomes a theme in your book, that the problem of, I think just to sort of summarize, the problem with Jefferson is that he has this like assumes a view about sovereignty, particularly a kind of sovereign view of freedom, that the people have sovereign control, I think, or sovereign agency. I'm not sure. You ask how you put it, over their fate, and this becomes a particular problem. And I mean, this is one of the, I think, main targets of the book. You want to maybe say a little bit more about sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there were, as I was writing the book, there were lots of interesting discussions going on in political theory about sovereignty. Some people trying to salvage it, some people saying we just have to get rid of it. And so it was also a way just to read the material that was out there that our colleagues were writing that was really great. And so the idea of freedom as having something to do with control, I thought, was really compelling, and seeing examples of that and the way freedom has been discussed and has a particular shape, especially in the contemporary United States, as control. I'm free when I'm king of my castle, right? I'm free when I'm, there are all these examples we can think of in pop culture. And then there, we also see it in academic political theory and philosophy. And so conceiving of freedom in this way, that I'm not really free unless I can insulate myself, make myself invulnerable, that to me seems, you know, after during the course of writing this book, became more and more clear how problematic that was. So freedom is conceived as overcoming something or shedding all the obstacles or obligations or things that hold you back. And instead, in the book, I want to think of freedom as responding to the world, right? Or responding to that web of relationships in which one finds oneself, right? Rather than figuring out a way to get around them. And so that, I think, is one of the real targets. Also thinking about, I don't know, this... think about the transitioning into thinking about Rawls and linking that with the Jeffersonian argument. And I earlier referred to Jefferson as sort of an idealist in this sense. And I think Rawls has often been seen that way. And some people often point to that with Habermas. So the deliberative theorists, the theories of justice coming out of Rawls, or this theory of sovereign freedom tracing back to Jefferson, all of these in some ways posit this idea, right? And then politics flows from that and we can figure it out. And I think I've always been, without using the term, because I have suspicions about the rhetorical work it's doing, a realist in sort of a fundamental way, right? How are these things really happening? What's really going on here? And I think that's what I was trying to do with each of those three bodies of thought, right? They're doing away with conflict. They're making it seem like we can solve this by either demanding sovereignty or figuring out the just discount rate with a graph, or assigning some proxy representative to do this in the legislature. And I think the problem's ultimately just going to be a lot messier than that.
Yeah. And that, I think that really gets to your critique of the Rawlsian distributive approach, that, you know, as if we can develop some kind of rational abstract calculation for getting our duties straight, for understanding the material needs of the future. And yeah, I mean, so I can see that realist streak in your thought, that the problem with these previous accounts of international justice, the approaches that they take aren't feasible in a certain way. But I also detect in your thought the idea that it's not just that these approaches are not feasible, but it's also that they're in some ways that are not desirable approaches, because they in some way impoverish our approach, our relationship with future generations, and the past generations, in the way that we were just talking about, the sort of Burkean approach, right? That, you know, that the kind of view about non-sovereign freedom that you're talking about it's good because it lends itself to a kind of openness and vulnerability to others, and that that sort of enriches human experience, whereas being closed off and invulnerable kind of closes you in on yourself and atomizes and impoverishes you. Is that right? Maybe we'll say a little bit more about that kind of approach. Yeah.
That latter view is actually just a myth or impossible, right? Yeah. It's never the case. You're never going to succeed in doing that. And that urge to get there is actually destructive, right? Not necessarily the urge, the steps one would take to try to do that is destructive. So that move is dangerous and problematic, whereas this other one allows us to live, I think, a richer, more politically, democratically engaged life. Right, where we're really taking other people in their unique differences from us and letting that affect us. I was thinking, you know, think about aging, right, as people age. And as my parents have aged, I've learned a lot about elder care options and how we approach aging in this country. And so this is a little aside, but thinking about, you know, there's this idea, many people are not, what I found in talking to elder care agencies was that people are not planning for old age. And we have this idea, right, that we live in single family homes in this country. They're usually, if it's more than one generation, it's just parents and underage children, right? The successful family, right? This myth, this ideal version, is, you know, a family raises children, the children turn 18, they move out, they start their own place, right? They have their own household. They're not living at home. Oftentimes the grandparents are not living at home. And again, this is an ideal type, right? And then as you age, it turns out you can't really live alone, or in many cases you can't. You need some care. Right. If only to when you fall, you need someone to notice that you fell. And so that's why we see people, you know, the help I've fallen in, the life alert buttons that people can get or things like that. This idea that I'm going to try to live on my own as long as I can. And then when you can't, right, you go to some elder care facility and just hearing the prices. Those facilities and learning more about the options, I was kind of floored. And that's why they talk about a coming elder care crisis as the baby boom generation needs more and more. It's pretty appalling. You can buy, this is getting back to that point, you can buy your way out of all these problems. For $5,000 a month, you can go to the nice elder care facility in our town. That's $5,000 for each person. Something like that. And just thinking about older people living on fixed incomes in retirement, right? Okay, so that's not an option. So what do you do? And talking to a number of social workers, they said, well, you move in with your children, right? That is what you're supposed to do. But that conversation's sort of missing. I think it was very difficult for my parents to imagine ever moving back in with their children, right? They were baby boomers. So, right? Like, no. And you watch commercials and you see retirement is about living and doing all these things. And it's not about adding on a first floor apartment so your elders can live with you. And just, you know, the link between this idea of freedom as control and not dependency, coupled with this capitalist idea that we can purchase everything and buy our way out of these problems is pretty potent. And then it turns out the lived experience isn't actually that for many people, right? If you have a great deal of money, you can do that. But, and those I think are the stories that we assume will be ours too often.
Yeah. And that's a really great example. I hadn't thought about that example in this context, but it certainly seems right to me. And of course, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, the government doesn't provide sufficient support to, you know, it sort of follows culture in this way, our culture in this way, instead of trying to encourage overcoming that tendency towards independence, which could be developed into public policy in certain ways, sort of giving support to families to live together as opposed to live separately.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or paying for renovations to make that possible. And I think there is some movement to try and make that happen. Mm-hmm. And I found it varied wildly by state. The state I live in now, Massachusetts, has very different supports and policies than my parents' home state and where I grew up in Florida. It was fairly shocking to see how different life could be in different states in the United States. And of course, that's affected by different political currents.
Yeah, good. So let's shift over to talking about the plays. I wanted to talk first by the way that you sort of set up discussing the plays, which is the notion of narrative, which you argue is crucial for approaching intergenerational justice, and touches on some of the things that we've been talking about, this sort of connection to the past and to the and to future generations. Not as mediated through a kind of abstract rational calculus in the way a sort of Rawlsian would do, but in terms of a kind of common narrative, narratives that we share, that are embodied in certain common works of art. And you turn to the Greek plays, which is great because the Greek plays were very public and everybody shared in them. So maybe let's start by talking about the notion of narrative and why, you know, what the benefits are. If you want to add, you know, elaborate on what the benefits are of narrative, both in approaching understanding what our duties are and in the motivational point that I think you addressed earlier.
Yeah. So I think given my emphasis on motivation, I'm trying to look at what are those things that could motivate us. And while, I often enjoy reading abstract philosophy, I'm not convinced others that's as widely shared as I would like it to be sometimes. So what are those other things? And, you know, here it's, I was influenced a lot by Iris Marion Young's work, Jade Schiff's, my own experience of reading ancient Greek work in graduate school and what's kept, you know, there's this way in which parts of Thucydides could capture my attention in ways, you know, reading what we have from Aristotle was just never going to do. And so I had this experience myself. So at that point, you know, it's a hunch. And then as I did more reading on the possibilities of narrative, you know, I came up with an idea about how it could, in this particular case, be useful. And so I argue in the book that because they're concrete but indeterminate, and in this way, they call on the reader, the viewer, to enter into that conversation, the meaning isn't entirely clear. It could be intentionally ambiguous. And so that is part of the practice of developing one's judgment. So that's one huge advantage. There's this emotional motivation, this affective force that can result from storytelling in a way, I think in some ways we just take for granted. I try to really describe it more concretely in the book, how exactly that works. But I think one of the examples I use is of Flint, where we could think about the recent issues, crisis on the border, right? People who heard the phone calls from parents looking for their children, right? That hits the news like wildfire because it's so moving, right? The concrete emotional pool of it is quite different from just reading the Washington Post headline about parents separated from children. So that's another aspect. A narrative often, almost always, implies this temporal aspect, right? Things take place in time. In some way, things develop over time. And so it can draw our attention immediately or sort of explicitly to time. And lastly, because they can be such a part of everyday life, right? We're encountering narratives all the time. People are always watching TV. They're listening to music that might be telling a song. They are seeing art. They are telling stories themselves. So to me, in Athens, right, there was this form of entertainment that was widely shared, that was seen as part of the education of citizenship in the polis. So I think for all those reasons, narrative makes this obvious source for the kind of work I was trying to do in the book.
Yeah, so let me just follow up on the motivational point, because I have sympathy with your view of how art narrative can help motivate citizens, but in some ways it can motivate us in the wrong way. So,
right.
So stories and that these sort of personal accounts can pull on the heartstrings, but they can also manipulate us in ways, in a certain way. I think it's Paul Bloom, the Yale psychologist, had this book called Against Empathy, because he just got fed up by all of these, you know, sort of stories about the, you know, you hear the heartstrings about all these poor white kids, but you don't hear anything. You know, your heartstrings aren't pulled because you don't hear the stories about other races, say, or, you know, your heartstrings can be pulled in certain ways that may pull you away from actually what are the real problems that are out there. And I had on Ronald Beener a couple episodes ago, who was talking about how the thinkers, artists can be really dangerous. So he cited Nietzsche and Heidegger as thinkers who are very seductive and can seduce our senses. So, I mean, what's your take on that? As far as you think that's a cost that's readily borne when thinking about art and its relation to politics?
Yeah, no, I love this question and thinking about it. And the podcast with Beener was super interesting on this. But as I was listening to it, I felt myself getting agitated in this good way. I'm really stressed out. Oh, right. Because I'm looking around me and seeing exactly what he's talking about, right?
Yeah.
And so I go back and forth. Maybe I'll figure it out in talking to you, and that would be great. So I do think we have these experiences that move us, and that is useful. I'm also persuaded by Arendt's concern about them, right? And her rejection. Like, I'm with that. The part of me really likes the unsentimental view. That Deborah Nelson in her book Tough Enough talks about this in respect to a bunch of Diane Arbus and Arendt and Jim Didion, and it's just great. And so I'm more attracted to the unsentimental view, but that doesn't mean it doesn't move us, right? Like looking at reality as it is and crafting stories about it. Now, the role of empathy in there, I think, is a tricky one, and I see the dangers. And I'm not sure, I mean, I think I'm trying to avoid that language, but I'm not sure that actually deals with the problem you're talking about.
It strikes me that, you know, one of the useful things about your analysis is the, you know, is the indeterminacy point that you start with, which is, so you're not, sort of universally approving of all forms of emotional manipulation, I guess, just to use that the more pejorative language, but you know, it's particularly that those forms of affect that emerge from our encounter with works that are indeterminate, which not all works of art are, right? I mean, the popular music of today, I hate to slam on popular music, it makes me sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but this is not indeterminate at all, right? It's very straightforward what's going on and what it means.
But it can be taken up in new ways.
Yeah.
Right. So there is still that room. You don't know what the effects really are going to be, or when the tipping point is for something. And so, right, even with the most clear, I think about that song because I heard it the other day and was surprised. Oh, people are still playing that Blurred Lines.
Oh, right.
Remember that? Right. It comes out and everyone loves it and it's super catchy and it's like a number one hit. I should fact check that. I'm not sure it was, but it's super popular. You heard it all over the place. And then within like a year, we're like, oh, right. It's super creepy. Right. And maybe part of rape culture. And we should think about this a little more, right? Like the meaning of that song shifts so much, right? Within just this short little time period. I do think, right, I don't want to make a whole big deal out of Blurred Lines or pop music, which I do, the, I don't know, the 13-year-old in me is still right here. Mm-hmm. I do love a lot of it and probably think about it too much. But even those meanings still shift, right? And what they mean for us. So I don't want to just limit it to what the writer or artist intended.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I mean, it strikes me, I mean, one of the benefits of, I guess you would say, an intentionally indeterminate, play, mm-hmm. you know, like an Aeschylus or Aristophanes or whatever, is the fact that it actually opens up reflection at the same time as affect, right? So like a Blurred Lines doesn't open up reflection. It actually closes it down and just makes you feel for a while. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's, at least that when I think, and if you've heard the podcast before, I'm influenced by the Germans. So, you know, Kant is deeply influential on me in thinking about art and the way that he thinks of art as the best kind of art is a play among the faculties, that it's not just a sort of purely affective encounter, mm-hmm. but it's a way in which, right. you know, the work of art isn't, it's not conceptual. It's not purely affective because it's not sort of enclosed within each of those, but it's sort of indeterminate in both ways and opens up mm-hmm. a reflection and drives her right. Does that make sense? So that when it opens up reflection, you have the chance for a kind of critical distance to it as well.
Right. And I think, you know, so that's, I think one of the problems with empathy, with that approach, right. I think Arendt's point is it sort of obliterates that move to the judgment, to the thoughtful reflection on that thing. And some things are so enormous, right? She's writing about the Holocaust, right? And totalitarianism. These things are so big and they require our attention in this way. That doesn't mean they don't move us either. I mean, of course they should, but when we're thinking about them politically, it has to be more. Maybe it's not a... Right. We all know the person who gets so overcome by their emotions, they're kind of useless in the moment. Right. I'm just going to stay in freak out mode rather than go to address the problem. And so I'm very wary of that. And especially right. thinking about something like climate change. Right. I think we're very susceptible to freak out mode. And well, there's nothing I can do beyond not using a plastic straw. So screw it. Right. I'm going to keep on doing what I do. I am not of the mind that our individual consumer choices are going to be the big difference maker here. Right. We need something much more radical and huge on the scale of government. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I share the worry about texts and emotion and where it could go. So, and I think that on the other hand, it opens up this, right? So we need to argue for our readings, the ones we want to make, because I think this stuff is out there and it does have this effect, right? So how do we, you know, we're engaged in that process now, talking about what is a better or worse reading of this or that piece of art, or to go back to the horrible Blurred Lines example, right? People argued over the meaning of that song. And now you very rarely hear it, mm-hmm. right? Because people sort of came, there was sort of this movement to say, this song is part of what the huge problem that we're trying to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can do that. And I think right now in the U.S., to go back to the concerns about Nietzsche, right? In the U.S., we're locked in that struggle right now, and it seems very serious. It's not just about, Beyonce or Taylor Swift or something. We're having this argument about what reality is. Mm-hmm. And part of that, as noted in the other podcast, is related to discussions of, or thinking about, you know, academic texts, thinking about Nietzsche and Heidegger. That was really interesting and scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about the Greek plays that you, that you discuss. You talk about several plays by Aristophanes, Euripides, and Aeschylus in the three chapters you take up. So the first, you discuss Aristophanes, and you talk about his Nights and the Clouds. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could first start by talking about the Nights, which is a wonderful play. And out of all the plays, I know the Nights and the Clouds the best, and so it was just great to to read your take on them. Maybe you could first start, for those who don't know the Nights, maybe you could just briefly summarize the plot of the Nights, and then maybe take us through what your reading of the Nights is, and why it's relevant to your theme here.
Mm-hmm. So in Nights, we have an old man, Demos, who is, I mean, keep the plays all separate in my mind. This is what I was nervous about in working up to the podcast recording was, will I keep all the details straight? So correct me.
No
since
problem.
You read these carefully. So in Nights, we have this old man who is, people are currying favors from and sort of fighting over his attention. So it's him and the, everyone open their books.
I have the Loeb over there. It's been about 20 years since I've read Greek, so I don't know if I'd be any use in that.
You know, and Nights is so clearly to me about Athenian politics. You know, it's pretty clear, right? He names the character Demos, and there's this elderly man's household, and he's got this slave that's meant to was read as Cleon, actually, the Athenian politician. And this old man keeps thinking he's getting what he wants from his slave, that his slave is doing his bidding. But he's actually, the slave himself, is Paphlagon, is just always flattering the man and actually cheating him in these ways. And in the end, salvation comes from this other guy who comes along and says, I'm really going to help you and give you what you really need. And they have this fight over Demos. And in the end, Demos, the sausage seller, this other guy who came along to save Demos, ends up rejuvenating him, and he returns and moves out back out to the country where there's not all this chatter and chaos. To me, the theme of the elderly in Aristophanes was always very clear. And many people would read Aristophanes and say, right, the old men sort of win out always in these plays. And when I would read the plays, I'm like, these old men are terrible, right? And they're not actually winning on the end. You know, now whether or not Aristophanes thought moving to the country was actually, you know, I think you can read that, right? Get out of politics. It's too messy. Leave Athens alone. Move back out to the country. Seems like a positive thing for him. But at least in Nights, right, he's not, the old man doesn't win. He becomes his younger self again, which I guess could be winning, right? But there's this idea that old age is the problem, right? That he's decrepit, right? And that decrepitness is connected with how he's experiencing political life in the city. It's out of his control. He can't really even command his own household, right? He's not king of his castle. And that's because he's, you know, gotten old and senile, right? So that just seemed ripe for discussion, given what I was interested in.
Yeah. So if you could just say a little bit more about Aristophanes' view of old age and as it's connected with, mm-hmm. with our finitude, right? I mean, the old age is connected, it's close to death. I mean, one reading is to say that, well, this is Aristophanes' own view, is that when you get old, you become senile. Another view is, you know, he's sort of playing on the Athenians' own worries about their own finitude and their desire to assume this kind of sovereign freedom of permanent youth, right? The youth are the ones that are self-sufficient and permanently in charge. And, you know, Aristophanes is sort of poking fun by giving them into their own fantasy and flattering them in the same way that Paphlagon and Sausage Seller are. I mean, what's your take, right. take on that? I think I sense both views in both interpretations in your view, but what's your take on that?
Yeah, and that was a really that dynamic of Aristophanes coming out and engaging in flattery himself, but also, and he does that in the play, but also saying, I'm also worried about this. I am producing this play at this moment in time. I've seen how you treat my older colleagues, the other, right? Which is also just a dig on the other comic playwrights. But, when they got old, you tossed them aside, mm-hmm. and I don't want that to happen here. And so he's, in this particular play, there is this move that we can read. How intentional was it? I don't know. This move we can read Aristophanes making, where he's trying to connect with the audience, right? And flattering them at this, maybe through flattery, but also through this, commiseration, through this, I'm one of you. I am also facing this reality of aging. But, what would be really great is if we could get back to the Athens of a generation ago, back when we were all young, and our politics weren't so messed up and we weren't surrounded by these demagogues who are convincing us that they're working for us, but in fact, they are working for themselves. Right. And so I think just the figure of the old man there is a useful figure for him to critique Athenian politics, but it depends on those particular understandings and fears about old age.
So Aristophanes, he's not trying to say something like, well, look, we should rethink how we think about old age. We should think that the old people are wise and so forth. So that's not his view.
Yeah, that's not the view I'm taking from these two particular plays, right? And so we also have Clouds, right? Where you have a father and son pair. Father's trying to get the son to do what he needs. He needs him. He's too old to go back to school, in air quotes, to go learn these new rhetorical techniques. So he's going to send his smart, but also his smart son, but the one who's also gotten him into all this debt. He's going to go learn these rhetorical techniques in the father's mind and then argue his way out of his father's debts. And then it all goes horribly. The son goes and studies with Socrates, and it turns out the son turns on the father rather than helping him out. And in the end, the father goes and just burns down Socrates, the thinkery. It doesn't end well.
No.
Peter, you even called it a hybrid, right? It's a tragedy. It's not a funny comedy in the end. And so I don't see this, if we get old, we get wise, and then things are better. What I see is we get old, we make a lot of horrible decisions. Those decisions come back to haunt us in some way. And that's what happens. And isn't that funny to laugh at?
Yeah. So what's the lesson for intergenerational justice then? How, could maybe connect that back to the broader themes for us.
Right. Which is that these aren't easily resolved tensions, right? That I think from my mind, I approach the question of intergenerational justice thinking about the future and the sort of in that Jeffersonian way, right? The future has these rights and the previous generation needs to get out of the way, right? And give them their due. And that's my own intuition. And in many ways, that's deeply problematic, right? For the thinking about it in terms of that tension doesn't go away. Once, that generation's still with us, if we're thinking about actually existing generations, giving up that hold on freedom, making way for the next generation, is not just a simple matter of telling them, you need to do this. Right? It's going to generate anxieties, tensions, problems. And those are just there. Aristophanes doesn't solve it for us. I think he just illustrates that conflict that remains there. And I think, when I'm looking at some of those distributive approaches to questions of intergenerational justice, or even the representational, it's just it's an easily solved problem, apparently. And I just don't think it is.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So it's a sort of, it's a critique of Jefferson and sort of so far as it points out that we have this desire for, every new generation to have its sovereign control, but also points out that that comes with the cost of shoving aside these old senile men, right? That be the previous. Okay.
Yeah. We also always imagine ourselves as the new ones.
Right. We're never.
Yeah. And I think that's part of it. Maybe right. Like we see ourselves. That's part of what I like about what Aristophanes is doing is he's pulling you into the perspective of the old man in certain ways, right? The sun, that's just not the interesting character in Clouds, for example. We're thinking about it. We're seeing him make these mistakes. We're spending our time with the father, not with the son. And then in Nights, Aristophanes talks about approaching aging himself. And so we see it from that perspective rather than the young upstart who's here to take our place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about the plays by Euripides, the Trojan Women and Medea, which both focus on the portrayal of motherhood. And so in that way, it's sort of connected with the relationship among generations, but have very, very different, very different takes or very different approaches. So maybe we start with the Trojan Women, where you start. Maybe, say a little bit about the plot and what you take to be the message.
Yeah. So this chapter was horrible to write because these plays are so, so depressing and sad, right? I go from Aristophanes with the potty humor, right way to say it, and then I go to stories about people throwing children off city walls, right? It's just it's terrible. So Trojan Women is the aftermath of the war, right? And we're left with, it really focuses on Hecuba. I talk in the book about how the play itself, there's not a whole lot that happens. It's really a extended lament, which allows me to talk about where we can find agency when there's, you know, this powerlessness. So I talk about the agency of grief, which thanks to Bonnie Honig's work on mourning in Athens, we can really see how transgressive that was in certain ways and how it being the only option had to be so. So that play is, you know, over the course of the play, the moment that always gets me, that stuck out to me, is the murder of the last remaining heir to Troy. And I always get the name is always hard for me. Astyanax. There we go. I think that's the right way. You know, that scene is just terrible. And then Hecuba's left to bury her grandson and is lamenting all that work. There's also Andromache in it, plays a big role. And she's talking about how she fulfilled these motherhood roles so well, and it was all for nothing, right? And throughout, there's a lot of focus. Euripides in both plays really focuses on that physical and emotional connection between mother and child. And so that allows me to think about the material practices, right? Because I don't want it to be a story of, you know, aren't mothers awesome and here to save us all, right? That's not my thing. But to think about the material practices of caring for another person, which at this moment in time, you know, is much of that work is shouldered by women. I don't think it has to be that way. But thinking about how that puts them in this in-between place generationally and maybe reveals certain insights about dependency, connection between people that when we look at a different model of human, right, the 30-year-old unencumbered male, we see something really different. And so start there with the mother to theorize instead.
Yeah, and this is also, I mean, I found this interesting, your discussion of it, because it's precisely the Trojan women who are, this is about the Trojan women who are captured after the end of the war at Troy. And it's it'd be amazing to put oneself in that perspective, that your entire society basically is gone, right? You've been defeated.
You're wiping it out intentionally.
What's that? Say again.
They're wiping it out very intentionally,
yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah, and so this is the end of the intergenerational chain, right? You don't see any right. the perpetuation of yourself in the future, and so you can't participate in that measure of immortality that can come from the transmission from generation mm-hmm. to generation. So yeah, I mean, what is it? Say more about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's why the play is just a lament, right? There's nothing left. You know, or if there is, right, like, I guess Andromache could, I'm not sure if there's a story about what happens after with her. I'm trying to think, right. She's going off to be remarried to an Athenian. So I guess, right. She had a young child. She could still have, she might have now, not Athenian, a Greek, sorry. She's going to go off and bear Greek children. Right. It's so hopeless throughout. And so that's why I can't really, you know, there's only so much one can do, I think, with that. And so in this case, I'm coupling it with another play by Euripides, and one that is really hard to grapple with if I'm making this argument about the material practices of caring for others reveal these outlines of dependency or situations of dependency in which we all actually exist. So I go to the next play, right, where I can see, oh, here's a mother who chooses to that destruction, right? It's not because the Greeks came along and did it. She's making that choice in a vengeful way.
Yeah. And so say a little bit about that story, which is interesting. Why does she do it?
Right. So she comes along, Medea has left her family of origin for Jason. She's living with him, and now he's left her, right? So she doesn't, I think it's interesting. He was her whole world at that point. She has left her past behind in this way. And now he sees opportunity elsewhere and has left her. And all she has these two children, and she makes a decision. It's foreshadowed by the children's nurse, who says, I'm worried she's going to do something terrible. Of course she is. And she chooses to murder her children to punish her husband. I think a lot of us know the story, even if we haven't read the play. I knew it long before I read it. And then in reading it, I was always struck by her connection to the children. And there's this weird way, and others have pointed this out, in which she has this heroic moment, right? As the hero, she has to overcome everything she is and wants in the world in order to do this act, right? She's sacrificing herself. It's so perverse to talk about like this, to murder her children in order to retain her honor. Right. And that's just such a different thing than I expected the play to be about the first time I read it. If that makes sense.
Well, I mean, it's pretty sure I haven't read the play. So it's pretty amazing to think that Euripides could make her into a hero in that way, or make her, I mean, if not a hero, then at least noble, right? Noble and beautiful.
That you read that in there, but I think the fact that it's this woman doing it, this woman murdering her child, prevents you from really going that far. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Right. You can read that into it and see he's making these moves, right? Right. Oh, she's a lot like Achilles here and here and here. Ooh, and not here at all. Right. But she's not legible, to use that kind of phrasing, as a hero.
So is Jason then the sort of tragic hero of that play, or is it there's?
Oh, he's such a classically.
Oh, I see. Guy. Okay.
You know, as I'm reading, I'm thinking, wait, and of course I'm bringing some of, you know, my own horizon to it. But as I read it, you know, it's just so useless. He seems arrogant. He doesn't seem like a real, I don't, the play to my mind does not generate a lot of sympathy for him either. You know, like, cause you know, she left her family, helped him defeat her family, destroy her family to be his wife. And now he's really left her, and so callously. Right. And he doesn't really seem to care, and he doesn't seem to see what's on the horizon. He so discounts her. No sympathy for Jason. Here.
Well, and it's really striking, you know, just back out for a second. I mean, onto a lot of these Greek plays that, in the Greek myths in general, there's so many stories about the sort of self-destruction of families, children killing parents, parents killing children, sometimes parents cooking children, serving them as food. Yes. But then on the other side, and I think about what I wanted to ask you about was Oedipus, of course. Oedipus mm-hmm. in some ways seems to fit your model quite well, which is that Oedipus is this figure who aspires to the kind of sovereign freedom that you're talking about, and sort of transcend the relationships of generations, because he marries his mother, right? And so is sort of skips right. a generation, and so sort of stands outside of the generative line. I mean, do you have a general take on Oedipus, and do you see that fitting in here, or you know, and more broadly in the context of these Greek myths, this sort of self-destruction of the family, is it connected to your theme in that way, that sometimes the Greeks have this kind of aspiration for sovereign freedom, which is a form of hubris that's then defeated?
Yeah. So it was great that you asked about Oedipus, because I'm going to work on that essay Good. Next. And so I'm actually thinking a lot about that, right? And of course, you know, using the word sovereign here is anachronistic. That's not necessarily, but there is, you know, we just keep seeing this attempt at control, right? And I think Arlene Saxenhouse's discussion of tyranny, right? Control without limits in ancient Greek, maybe, is the analogy I would draw. And she's talking about that explicitly with reference to Oedipus. We're trying to get that control, and yet life always outruns those efforts, right? And I'm trying to draw attention to the way it does because of our, in the chapter on Euripides, for example, our connections among one another and our vulnerability to one another, and also the ways in which we're, you know, part of this larger assemblage is the language I'm using in that chapter. And Oedipus is, right, he's cast out, so he's sent out of his family, except he's totally in his family. And so you always have those moves going on, and he thinks his clever mind, right, will be able to master the situation. And for a long time, it seems to do that until it all comes horribly crashing mm-hmm. down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the procession between the generations, I think that was one of the things I was really trying to get to in that last chapter, right, on with Aeschylus and his work, because it seems very obvious there, given the stories he chose and the way he chose to.
Yeah. So you talk about the Oresteia in that last chapter. So just take us through what's your take? Why do you talk about it? What do you think the connection is with intergenerational responsibility?
Yeah. And I would say this is a play that really first brought me in to focusing the book in this way. So I mentioned at the start that I was interested in these holes in how we were thinking about citizenship, and could we be more expansive about it? And the Oresteia was the first entry point to this, because I'd always seen that in the play, that often, you know, when you read the play, maybe in class or sort of conventional readings of the play in the literature that I'd seen, really focus on the establishment of justice in Athens, right, and the connection to democracy. And the whole time I'm reading it, I'm just saying, you know, I'm feeling for Orestes and Electra being caught in this moment, sandwiched between, you know, having to make these difficult choices and trying to, that they, you know, had no part in creating this situation, right? And that always, I always found that especially moving. And so I wanted to work with that. And then, you know, you read the backstory to the family and you realize this is many generations older than them and starts with the feeding the children to the father. And so how do we deal with that terrible inheritance, if that is our inheritance, if it's something that terrible? And if we're connected to this really violent past, how are we going to deal with that? And Orestes begins, you know, I begin with Agamemnon, so that's done. But in the moving to the libation bearers and the Eumenides, Orestes commits an act of violence, right? He's continuing that chain, but then there's this moment, right? And that's what gets connected with the establishment of rule of law and democracy in Athens, where maybe there's a different resolution possible. Maybe we can stop it, but you can't stop it on your own, which was what each generation kept trying to do, right? Clytemnestra is like, okay, killed Agamemnon, everything's fine now.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know the Oresteia as well as I should, but I guess the end point, you know, and so just one of our first documents for this sort of, yes, you could say the transition from the state of nature to civil society, the state where, you know, you have these cycles of revenge to the institution of the rule of law. But is there, I mean, what happens to those crimes or injustices that exist before in the state after the institution of this law? Do those become before a court of law, or are they just forgotten? Right. I think of this in the context of, say, you know, like contemporary discussions about reparations and so forth. And so look, what happens to past crimes in a new era of law? Cause it's not like people just simply forget when all of a sudden you have law over you.
Right. Right. And I think there are people, you know, I mentioned Jeff Spinner-Halev's work earlier, right? There are people who are really thinking about that. And he, and I hope I recreate his argument correctly, thinking about how that injustice, that historical injustice extends into the future. So I think reparations is a really helpful example there, right? You think that injustice still exists now, right? It has this historical root in the transatlantic slave trade, right? But we see reverberations now that could be addressed, right? We don't just have to say, oh, that happened way back. I grew up mostly in North Florida in the Deep South, so that was always one that really interested me. And you always heard, well, my family wasn't here, right? That wasn't my family, right? As if somehow that released one from the responsibility for that enduring injustice in the present. And my family wasn't here, my white family, right? Thinking about white people making that argument. You know, my family came in 1930. We had nothing to do with it, as if it were in the past, but it precisely wasn't, right? And so I think there's a way to deal with that. Something like Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, right, which are dealing with a more immediate past, right, have been one way of dealing with that. What we see in the Oresteia, right, is the way the past gets sent down beneath the city. So you have in the end of the play, the Furies, who were the ancient goddesses tormenting Orestes for murdering his mother, right? Because matricide is a bad thing. And these are older gods that Apollo just says, you know, get out of here. You have no business here. But Athena's trying to balance that, right? We can't just wipe them out, is her approach. And so she offers them a place of honor in the city where they will now, you know, instead of punishing matricides like this, which presumably wouldn't be handled in the same way anymore now that we have courts, you know, they will have a place of honor beneath the city and be responsible for things like childbirth, right? And so there's a way of paying, giving honor to something like that, or addressing the past. They aren't just vanquished by Apollo.
It's like a sublimation of the dark urges. Is that essentially what's going on?
Yeah. So there are different ways of reading it too, right? So I just gave the really cheery reading, which is they get hard and everything's fine. And Pachter Markel has this great reading, I think based on a particular production he saw, where in fact they are bound. It's on the cover of the his book, right? In fact, they're bound and sort of shoved beneath the city rather than given this place of honor. I think, again, the indeterminacy that we can read both readings into it and always remember those remainders and tensions that remain. I don't think it's going to be possible to resolve these situations, a situation like this, any historical injustice, without remainders, without dissatisfaction and anger. But that doesn't mean there aren't better and worse ways of dealing with them.
Yeah, right? I mean, one of the things I've found interesting in thinking about this is the sort of absence of forgiveness in the, or maybe I should ask you, I mean, is there any form of forgiveness in, because it strikes me one of the innovations of Christianity is thinking precisely through the kinds of cycles of revenge and punishment and the attempt at justice and the inability to achieve any kind of, sovereign responsibility over evil. And this is precisely the sort of innovation of Christianity, it seems to me, in the idea of forgiveness, or the idea of Jesus on the cross, is the idea of a kind of complete sovereign responsibility in the form of the divine over human evil writ large, right? And that's the aspiration, which finite human beings can't ever live up to, but at least that's the promise that's sort of embodied in there. That's not, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be present. I mean, there's an emphasis on justice and the rule of law and reparations and so forth, but the idea of forgiveness, and this of course comes back through in Hannah Arendt, that idea of forgiveness, in an interesting way, but that isn't really present. Have you thought much about sort of the role of forgiveness in this context?
Yeah, no, I haven't. for all my talk about motivation and affect and emotional pull, forgiveness seems very squishy to me.
Yeah, fair enough.
No, thinking more about, I'm interested in taking responsibility. Trying to think like forgiveness in a political sense, I would be open to being persuaded and could do more reading about where to place that. I don't, that's not something in the Greek plays that I'm looking at, right? It's just, how are we going to deal with this situation? It's never, that notion of forgiveness is not coming in there, whether, did it even exist? I'm sure there's,
King. Yeah, well, I think that.
No, we need to find that out.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of their sources that could tell us more, but I don't think that's there.
Yeah. I think taking responsibility is crucial to the story of forgiveness, insofar as that's what allows one to forgive. It's sort of because I'm partially responsible for what you've done, right? And too often this is connected with your earlier thought that we have this idea, especially in America, that it's, like when somebody does something wrong, that was their choice, their sovereign choice. They had sovereign control over what they did, right? And I'm going to punish them for it. I was not implicated in that at all. Whereas the idea of forgiveness is just sort of opposite. Well, I'm implicated in everything that is that is all the evils that are done, right? So I can forgive you for that, and that sort of ends that cycle of revenge in that way, right? Because you sort of transcend that cycle of revenge, you stand above it and incorporate it into your own. So it's a sort of like a, I don't know, I ask this because it's kind of hyper amping up of this sort of sovereign responsibility that you're talking about, but in a way to kind of overcome the problems. But I mean, it's sort of too late in the podcast to ask this big of a question, but in any case, if you have any further thoughts on that.
Well, trying to think about, you know, I'm really interested in that particular chapter of thinking a little more about institutional responses to this, or what role, right, how can we, you know, again, because I think of much of our approach to intergenerational issues, or to go back to climate change, right, is about individuals, right? And the chapter on Euripides really has me thinking about individual women with that powerless responsibility. Adrian Rich's phrase, which I think is so useful, right? You have this powerless responsibility for children, and what's that really mean? And how can we move from thinking about the individual and their freedom or unfreedom to institutions that might better capture that? Now, I'm not, at least in this mode, I'm not trying to imagine the concrete edges of what those institutions would look like, but just wanting to make a claim that we have to move sort of beyond that to a more institutional focus and an emphasis on taking responsibility for what we inherit, even if it's deeply unwanted.
Well, great. Thanks, Liz. This was so much fun to talk about these plays and this topic. So I really appreciate you joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Of course. It's great to be invited, and I look forward to listening to your future podcast.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.